preamble from the 40s. It's an AA group preamble. And anybody that knows me knows I'm very, very fond of the real old literature, the older writings around the 30s and 40s of this program, because they were very explicit, they were very hard to misunderstand, and they were right to the point, as we'll see with this preamble. Go ahead, Rich. Thanks a lot, Rich. We're going to be in the second half of Bill's story tonight. There is one thing I forgot to mention, though. There's been some concern about the cigarette butts being distributed tither and yon across the grounds here. Please confine them to the butt cans. I like to look at Bill's story as a 12-step call in print. And it's basically broken down really into two separate parts. What it was like, what the drinking did with Bill, where it took him, what some of his drinking experiences were like, and how far down the ladder he went. And then a little bit about what happened when Ebby showed up, and then his path to recovery, bringing him to the point where he wrote constructed the architecture of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from as many, many different religious and psychological sources and medical sources. But anyway, last week we covered basically his drinking, and I like to use that as an identifier for people. The first 60 pages or so concern themselves with the first step, and then there's maybe 40 pages after that that cover steps 2 through 12. So, I mean, that lets you know right there that there's a very important there's a very important message to be carried in the first step. Whenever I see somebody who has not done the steps, who goes to two meetings a week, is totally miserable, hates his family, you know, when you see somebody like that, you see somebody who really has never become convinced of the first step. Because if you become convinced of the first step, as it's laid out in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's only really two roads for you to take. One of them is to continue drinking and just forget everything you know to the best of your ability. And the other is to grasp onto this program to the best of your ability and recover from alcoholism, because it paints us into a corner. But you have to kind of pay attention to its message. I think one of the saddest things was when I first came into AA in the late 80s, the Big Book was a dust collector in practically every AA's bookshelf. You know what I mean? There was 12 and 12 meetings galore, but there was never any real work in the Big Book, or else I missed it. You know, maybe it was the receiver that was broken and not the transmitter. But through my experience working with others and through my experience studying the Big Book, I've really come to believe in my heart that the way out for us is to practice the principles in this book, to follow the instructions and to actually take them and to take the action that it lays out for us. And I've come to believe in that more and more by watching people do it. Besides myself, I've got my own experience, but watching the experience of other people, you see people catch fire spiritually who are really in this process. They're out there making amends, they're carrying the message into institutions, they're on fire, and their lives are changing. And I really do believe in this stuff. So we're going to concentrate on the second half of Bill's story tonight. And what I like to do is I like to ask people to watch what Bill did to recover. He lays out in a very, very simple form the structure of the program of recovery, and he talks about how he did it in his life. And I'll point out some of the many facts as we go through the story that I find pertinent and I can identify with. Start down on page 9, paragraph 5. This is when Ebby Thatcher walks in and goes, "I've got religion. You know, I've found Jesus and I'm not drinking anymore." And Bill wanted to throw him out, but he also wanted somebody to drink with. So he just invited the guy in. He goes, "I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. Bless his heart. Let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told him of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked." Roland Hazard, and I think the guy's name was Shep Cornell, showed up in court. Ebby Thatcher had been given one last chance in the town that he was living in. I think it was in Vermont. And you screw up one more time, the judge says, and I'm throwing away the key on you. And pretty soon after that, what he did was he got drunk as a goat, and he drove his car into a couple's kitchen. He went flying off the road, and amid the rubble of the kitchen, the couple is standing there, covered with dust, and he rolls down his window and he goes, "You got a cup of coffee?" So the judge was irate. So in come, I think it was Shep Cornell and Roland Hazard, and they said, "Judge, release him on to our recognizance. We're going to New York. We'll take him to New York with us. We've got a solution for his problem. We think we can help him, and we'll get him out of your hair." And the judge said, "Just make sure he never comes back." And he started to follow some of the program of action laid out in the Oxford Group, and they had some tenets in the Oxford Group. They had confession, they had restitution, they had what our 11th step is today: morning meditation and checking your guidance with other similarly guided people. They had carrying the message or witnessing. They had surrender. They had a lot of the things that we had. And what it did was it led to a spiritual awakening in Ebby Thatcher. And part of the spiritual awakening is to carry that message. So he finds out that one of his old drinking buddies, Bill Wilson, is in town, and he pays him a visit. This is where it all starts. He'd come to pass his experience along to me, if I cared to have it. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that pro-offered temperance pledge I never signed, my grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings, his insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen, his fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. He was raised by his grandfather. His father left, abandoned the family at a very young age. So he was raised by his grandfather. And his grandfather, if I look at this correctly, was agnostic. You know? So he was brought up agnostic. The wartime day in Winchester Cathedral came back again. I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. For that means blind faith in the strange proposition that the universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay it all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I had gone. With ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated, and my mind snapped shut at such a theory. To Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. Yeah, not too closely followed. His moral teaching, most excellent for myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. I also kind of sought spiritual ways of life when I was out there drinking and snorting cocaine, you know. I would read books on Zen and things like that. But I'll tell you what, I never put anything into practice that I learned. It was wonderful to read about it, and it made me feel warm and fuzzy for a period of time. But my life continued to turn into shit. The wars which had been fought, the burnings and chicanery that religious dispute had facilitated made me sick. I honestly doubted whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I had seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible, the brotherhood of man a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me. But my friend sat before me. He made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted a complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. You have to pay attention to something like that. You know, I can remember my first sponsor showing up in rehab and coming in with that glow, you know, those eyes. I mean, you knew there was a light on in the attic. And my light had been turned out a long time ago. And I remember seeing in him something that I wanted. And I ended up asking him to sponsor me as soon as I was done relapsing. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute. And this was none at all. That floored me. Remember, Dr. Silkworth had told Bill what his problem was. He had an obsession of the mind that would not allow him to quit liquor for good and for all. And he had the physical allergy, which would ensure his doom because it forces you to drink against your will once you start. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in the human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil. Remember the definition of the spiritual experience. I mean, this guy had a spiritual experience. He had a change of personality at depth sufficient to recover from a hopeless state of mind and body known as alcoholism. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I heard somebody say once, if I start praying, God will know where I am. You know? I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway may be. Not yet, Pat. He's practicing. I've since talked with scores of men who have felt the same way. My friend, here's that squiggly font, so everybody pay attention. My friend suggested that then what seemed the novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? You know, if you have some Old Testament, turn your wife to a pillar of salt, flood your lands, burn your city, wipe out your tribe kind of Old Testament God, get rid of the son of a bitch. You know what I mean? Get a different God. That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. What does that sound like? That sounds like step two. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. But you need willingness. For the spiritual awakening as a result of taking the course of action laid out in the book, you have to be willing. We don't just walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, oh, give me the book, I'll take it home, I'll do it. I mean, we have to have, our ass has to be to the fire. Nobody wants to do this stuff. It's become quite common in AA for people that are doing their amends to not go much further than the family, you know, their immediate family. I mean, you really have to understand the first step to want to do this stuff. It's not something that comes easy to us. It goes against our ego. And I've never met an alcoholic yet who isn't completely run by their ego when they walk in the rooms of AA. Thus, I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed, scales of pride and prejudice fell away from my eyes, a new world came into view. That's important. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have Him with me, and He came. But soon the sense of His presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself, and so it had been ever since, how blind I had been. I remember getting a real clear picture of God. I had this, like, God shot one time, and then the acid wore off. You know what I mean? These things don't last unless you're working a program of action, I believe. This is an important page. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. He's shaking himself sober in a hospital. And let's pay attention to this page and see what he does. There, I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood Him to do with me as He would. I placed myself unreservedly under His care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing and that without Him I was lost. That's our third step. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. That's 4, 6, and 7. I've not had a drink since. My schoolmate visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. He did a fifth step on his hospital bed with Abby Thatcher. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I like that. We made a list. He probably was shaking so bad he couldn't hold a pencil. So I have a feeling that Ebby wrote and he dictated. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. So that's the eighth step. Of course, he couldn't go out and make direct amends, so he had to wait with the ninth step until he got out of the hospital. But today when I still hear every once in a while, you do a step a year. Or, you know, take your time. There's no rush to do the steps. Bill Wilson did them all before he got off his ass. He did almost practically every one of them. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. We're talking about some 11-step stuff here. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as He would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. That's a theme throughout this book, to pray for yourself to get better in many ways so that you can help others more effectively. And that's a theme that we can follow. My friend promised that when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, and that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems, not just his drinking. Belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. Some people think I'm a hard sponsor because I beat up some of the guys pretty bad who are slipping and sliding. But it says here that there must be a destruction of our self-centeredness. And sometimes you got to beat on somebody's ego, you know. And you get to the point where you'd rather step on somebody's feelings than on their grave. And it's just important for that ego deflation at depth. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though a great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. And I believe it was sudden and profound because he did so much of the work sitting on the bed. A lot of people, when they read this book early on, thought they had to have one of those white light spiritual awakenings, like a sudden, you know, hits you in the head like a truck. And it was misrepresented. Upon careful reading, that's not true. So they had to add the spiritual appendix in the following editions to kind of clarify what they're talking about. And they talk then about the spiritual awakening being of the educational variety, happening slowly over a period of time after a course of action. For a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I was still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally he shook his head saying, "Something has happened to you. I don't understand, but you had better hang on to it. Anything's better than the way you were." The good doctor now sees many men who have had such experiences. He knows that they are real. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They might in turn work with others. And here he is, detoxing on a hospital bed. And in a moment of meditation, he came up with the thing that saved all of our lives sitting in this room tonight. You know, that's an amazing thing. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. 12th step. Faith without works was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. Everybody pay attention here. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And you hear people coming back. "I'm just coming back. I broke up with my girlfriend and I drank." Or, "I lost my job and I drank." I don't care what happened before you drank. I know that one thing happened before you drank. You failed to perfect and enlarge your spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, or you wouldn't be drunk. And that's just the way it is. Alcoholics like to place blame. And that's, you know, we're taking away that privilege when we go through the big book and we learn the principles in here. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping others, to the solution of their problems. It was fortunate for my business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. Yeah, I bet. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. I love Bill Wilson. I love his writings, but I know enough about him to know that he's human. And he had a lot of faults. And one of his faults was he went through the steps very, very quickly early on, and he was a laurel rester. Anybody in here understand about resting on your laurels, on yesterday's spiritual accomplishments? He was king laurel rester. He went through like a 16-year depression that he finally overcame by going back to the principles in the program. But Dr. Bob was not a laurel rester. Dr. Bob worked the steps over and over and over again in his life, and you do not find him admitting to depression. You do not find him being negative about some of the aspects of his life. And you do with Bill Wilson. So what he did was he talks about immunity from alcohol by working with others. That saved his ass time and time again from his depression and his self-pity. And he'd be me, 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 I, the alcoholic opera. Many times I've gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It's a design for living that works in rough going. Then he talks about a little bit more of the things that go on. Page 16, paragraph 2. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some will be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath there's a deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24-hour days in and through us, or we perish. We do have a lot of fun in here. Every once in a while, a non-alcoholic will wander into a speaker meeting, and somebody will be saying, "Yeah, and then I ran over the wife drunk, and the whole place will be laughing their ass off. And then I got excited, and I ran her over, trying to back over her." And the place will be in hysterics, and non-alcoholics will just be looking like, "Are these people crazy?" But we've come out of that stuff, so we can look back on it. And if you don't look back on it and laugh, you're going to look back on it and cry. Most of us feel we needn't look no further for utopia. We have it right with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a winding circle of peace on earth and goodwill toward men. I'll read a paragraph out of Language of the Heart. That's the collected grapevine writings of Bill Wilson. And I'm really a fan of this particular one. "We have since found that these awful conditions of the mind and body invariably bring on the third phase of our malady. This is the sickening of the spirit, a sickness for which there must necessarily be a spiritual remedy. We recognize this in the first five words of step 12 of the recovery program, having had a spiritual awakening. Here we name the remedy for our threefold sickness of body, mind, and soul. Here we declare the necessity for that all-important spiritual awakening." So, in that paragraph, I believe he talks about our solution. He talks about the treatment for alcoholism. And the treatment for alcoholism is a spiritual awakening. One of the things that I just didn't get with when I first started coming around AA was that the solution to my problem would be a spiritual awakening. A lot of people told me the solution to my problem would be an endless amount of meetings. The solution to my problem would be to get honest and talk with my sponsor. These are all very, very good things to do and probably vital. But it took me a long time to really come to the understanding that I needed a personality change at depth as a result of practicing the 12 steps to truly be a recovered, what they talk about in this book, as a recovered alcoholic. To truly have treated my alcoholism. And then I have to live the principles of the 12 steps on a daily basis to maintain it. We're going to be, for the next several weeks, we're going to be on step one. There's quite possibly 60 pages in the doctor's opinion that concern themselves with the first step. There's tons of information on the body, and the first step as it concerns the body is basically the phenomenon of craving. That is, anybody in here who's an alcoholic can definitely relate to having the sixth drink ask for the seventh drink, and the seventh drink asks for the eighth drink. And by the time you have your 12th drink, you want the 12th drink more than you wanted the third drink. That's the phenomenon of craving. That's the acetone in your bloodstream crying out for more acetone. And that makes us bodily different than normal people and normal drinkers. The second part of the first step is the mind. Why can't we, no matter how hard we try, give up drinking entirely on our own will, just deciding not to drink? I was talking with somebody earlier about this, how it clicked with me about the obsession of the mind was, I always thought I changed my mind. I swore off drinking in the morning with that nuclear hangover after crashing another car or whatever. But by the afternoon, I had changed my mind and I was on the way to the liquor store. I thought that was my willpower. I thought that that was me changing my mind. And I thought that coming into Alcoholics Anonymous would be like one giant pep rally saying, yay, yay, we don't drink today, and just trying to get my enthusiasm up to not drink. I thought that I just needed to not drink more. I didn't realize that I had an obsession of the mind that left me very, very little choice over whether I picked up a drink or not. And then the third part of the first step, which is often overlooked, is the spirit malady. And they talk about that in, there's a great paragraph in We Agnostics, and there's a little bit in the doctor's opinion. We feel restless, irritable, and discontented unless we feel that sense of ease and comfort that comes from a drink. We're full of fear, remorse, self-pity, resentment. Our life is not satisfactory, nor are we comfortable with ourselves and our environment. All those nameless little fears and anxieties that we have, that's the spirit malady. And I thought I was just a screwed up person. But once I started to recover from alcoholism, those things started to go away. And I realized they were part of the disease. I'm not saying that other people in society don't have those same problems, but I know that mine was aggravated by my alcoholism, and it started to go away as I started to practice the steps. We're going to start tonight on Chapter 2, There is a Solution. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. And that's true. I mean, look around. Would you find all of us at one party over in the Burrillsville Mountains or something? Yeah, no way. You might find us all in prison together or something. But we're people who normally would not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. And unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element of the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself never would have held us together as we are now joined. This is a construction reference, and I find them useful to note them when we get to them. Our common peril, our common problem as alcoholics, is one part of the cement which holds us together. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. That's another part of the cement, the common solution. We have a way out upon which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. That is a powerful sentence. What that says is the treatment for alcoholism, which they will give us in the form of the 12 steps in some of the following chapters, is a way out upon which the entire first 100 agreed. And they joined in brotherly and harmonious action practicing those steps to recover from alcoholism. You got to remember that there weren't widespread meetings at the time this book was written. As a matter of fact, there was no Alcoholics Anonymous meetings when this book was written. There was Oxford group meetings, which were basically just a very evangelical type of Christian fellowship where people got together and practiced some of the lessons that they learned from first century Christianity and other sources. So there really wasn't any AA at that time. You would not see a sign on the door, AA, and with a G underneath. We were going to Oxford Group at that time. There was some cliques of the Oxford Group. The drunks would get together, and they would start their own little gatherings, you know, the Oxford Group drunks. But the Oxford Group got pissed off about that, and what they basically said was, you guys are going off on your own thread and we're not real comfortable with that. So we really were finally forced to, maybe not forced, but the writing was on the wall for us to break away from the Oxford group, and we did that in the late 30s and early 40s. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out upon it, which we absolutely agree. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism, that there is a way out, and they're going to explain it. An illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him, and no one is angry or hurt, but not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it there goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgust of friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. It really is a disease. Well, I won't even call it a disease, because the book doesn't do that. The book calls it an illness and a malady. It is an illness that is still to this day misunderstood by the majority of people out there. They look upon it as a lack of willpower or something. It's so hard to understand alcoholism if you're not an alcoholic. Why don't you just stop drinking? You know, what is wrong with you? You must be nuts. I mean, it's so misunderstood. But I'll tell you what, it's a horrible disease. On the one hand, it's the worst disease to have, because every other fatal malady that I know of at least gives you the dignity of putting your affairs in order before you check out. You know what I mean? You can make amends to your loved ones and, you know, all that stuff. Alcoholism, when you're on the way out, that's the worst time for that kind of stuff. You know, you usually go out in disgrace. But it's the best disease to have, because you can recover from it by following spiritual principles. You can put it 100% in remission for the rest of your life by following certain spiritual principles and putting yourself in the right atmosphere for God to be able to relieve you of the problem. We hope this volume will inform and comfort those who are or who may be affected. There are many. Highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation without reserve. Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. A lot of times we don't know what the hell's going on, so it's hard for us to vocalize, you know. But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. This is what drives our spouses and our family nuts. For 20 years, we've been drinking our family into ruin. And let's say our wife or our husband has been doing absolutely everything in their power to try to keep us from drinking, to try to get us better. And one day we wander into an AA meeting and we meet a plumber named Wally, and we never take another drink. You know? They're like, what the hell did Wally the plumber say, for God's sake? You know? They've been working on us for 20 years. It's that identification. When I was in rehab, I signed myself into rehab. There was four counselors that would interact with me, at least, and the rest of the people I was with. And three of them were alcoholic, and one of them wasn't. One of them would identify herself as an adult child of an alcoholic. Now, this is before I knew any of the recovery banter. You know what I mean? And I thought that was a strange way to identify yourself. You know, I thought, you know, what the hell would I say? I'm an insane drinker from Basking Ridge, and a son of a librarian. I had, what difference does it make? I could never relate to this woman. She really tried, and she had a great heart, but there wasn't the identification that I had with the three other counselors, because the three other counselors were alcoholics. And they knew my language, and I knew theirs, and I couldn't get anything by them. You know what I mean? The codependent adult child, I could get stuff by. That the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he's obviously knows what he's talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he's a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude holier than thou, nothing whatever except a sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured, These are the conditions we have found most effective after such an approach. Many take up their beds and walk again. And back in the old days, taking up your bed and walking again was you took up the sheets off the bed when you were done being sick, and you washed them, and you got on about your life. You know, you were better. None of us makes a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. We feel the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. Note, a much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. That's an important sentence. There are a lot of people, not that I judge, for God's sake, there are a lot of people who come into AA and all they're interested in is not drinking. That's it. You know, don't hand me any of this psychobabble. I don't need my head shrunk. I just need to stop drinking. Thanks. And they go about their affairs the same way they did when they weren't drinking. And that's a recipe for disaster. You know, you'll see many of them drink. And if they're lucky, they'll maintain a very uncomfortable sobriety, white-knuckle version, being angry and resentful at the entire world, and probably go to the grave very bitter. All of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort that we're going to describe. A few are fortunate enough to be so situated that we can give nearly all of their time to the work. Most of these guys were unemployed, so that was easy. If we keep on the way we're going, there's little doubt that much good will result, but the surface of the problem would hardly be scratched. Those of us who live in large cities are overcome by the reflection that close by, hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. Many could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. How then shall we present that which has been so freely given us? We have concluded to publish an anonymous volume setting forth the problem as we see it. That's what we have in our hands. We shall bring to the task our combined experience and knowledge. I'll tell you what. I have been in enough step meetings in my life to honestly say I have probably been through the step book at least 150 or 200 times, the first part of the 12 and 12. And I can honestly say that I've done the big book thing that for a number of years and on my own enough times to say I've at least been through the big book 60 times. And I'll tell you what, I'm not knocking the step book. There's a lot of wonderful stuff in it, but it pales in comparison to the big book. It absolutely pales in comparison to the big book. One of the greatest crimes I see is there's 15 million 12 and 12 meetings, and there's like two big book meetings. The combined experience of the first 100 went into a lot of the concepts in this big book, and the 12 and 12 was basically Bill's vehicle, Bill Wilson. So you get one person's view in the 12 and 12, and you get 60 or 80 in the big book. And I think that's why I believe that this is so inspired a volume. Every time I go through this, nobody was more than like 3.5 years sober when this was written. And there are people 20, 30 years sober that go through this book, and every time they go through it, they see something new. They get a whole new revelation about a certain paragraph or idea. You know, that doesn't happen to me really with the 12 and 12. Not to the extent that it does with the big book. This should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with a drinking problem. So the program is going to be laid out in this book. And talking about the 12 and 12, it's basically a series of essays written after Bill was 19 or so years sober, looking back on his experience. And they were basically written to broaden and deepen the concepts that were laid out in the big book. So if anyone is trying to figure out how to do the steps by going to the step book, you're reading a sequel. All the action instructions are in the big book. They're really not in the step book. There is some further information that will allow you to broaden and deepen your experience with the steps, but it's not necessary. You can recover just fine never picking up a 12 and 12. I find the most important part of the 12 and 12 really is the second part, the traditions. Anyway, jump back off the soapbox. Of necessity, there will have to be discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. Most of us sense that real intolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. There are also attitudes I didn't have when I walked in here. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help to meet their needs. That's another concept that you'll find. There's a thread all the way through these chapters that really push us in the direction of being of service to other people. You may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us have become so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? Remember, this book was written to be sent out upon the tides of alcoholism. There was two meeting areas, Akron and New York, where alcoholics were gathering. And they concluded to publish this volume. One of the first things they did was they sent out postcards describing the book to literally thousands of doctors, thinking that the doctors would buy this book and then pass them out to all the alcoholic patients. I think like three doctors responded, and the handwriting was so bad they couldn't even read the addresses. It's like drunken doctors. But the idea was to give the recipe for recovery in the big book, so that you could take the book and recover from alcoholism all by yourself. You just needed to find somebody that would hear your fifth step and then find some other drunks to work with. Those were the things that you needed other people for, besides amends and stuff like that. So, it is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. Before getting into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we have seen them. How many times have people said to us, I can take it or leave it alone, why can't he? Here's a place where you can turn statements into questions. Ask yourself, Has any of this ever been said to you or about you? Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try drinking beer or wine? Lay off that hard stuff. I mean, people told me this all the time. Every time I drank tequila, I'd get arrested. People would say, why don't you just stay off tequila? It was like, oh, duh. She's such a sweet girl, I think that he should stop for her sake. That's my favorite, you know? You have such a sweet girl. Why don't you quit for her sake? It's like, what? Something like that didn't even register. But I would stop talking to such a person very quickly, you know. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him, but there he is all lit up again. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and some misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. Now they're going to go over some different types of drinkers. And everybody pay attention. There really are different scales to alcoholism and different types of drinkers. And it's not important to know what somebody else is, but it's very important to know what you are. Unless you're working with somebody and taking them through the steps, you know, that's up to them what they are. But I needed to know what type of a drinker I was, because I needed to know that I really had no other options but to do this work, because I don't like running around making amends. I don't like running around carrying the message into hospitals and jails. I've got better things to do, thank you. You know, so I really needed a reason to go through the steps. And finding out what type of an alcoholic you are is the fuel that you can use to motor through the rest of the work. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely. If they have good reason for it, they can take it or leave it alone. These are the type of people who you would meet in the bar, and they would stop by and they would have two drinks and say, got to go home to the wife and kids, you know. Or you would buy them a drink, hoping to keep them there so you'd have somebody to drink with. They'd drink the drink you just bought them and then leave before they'd buy you one. You know, these are moderate drinkers, and I hate them so much. Then are there the type of people that have a beer and a half? You know, you'll meet them on the plane. They'll order a whiskey sour, and they'll stir it for 15 minutes. And the ice will be melting. You know what I mean? It's like, hey, excuse me, your ice is melting. You going to drink that? You know? It still bothers me to see that. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. These are the people that look just like us. I had a roommate once. He drank just like me. We went into blackouts together. He'd drink rum and I'd drink bourbon, and we'd crash cars, we'd get arrested, we'd get thrown out of apartments, we'd trash houses. Side by side, we were there together. He met a girl, fell in love, took up housekeeping, and sipped wine. You know, the guy sipped wine. I drove my life into the toilet for like the next 6 years. You know what I mean? They're a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. The heavy drinker might die early because he drinks so much. But if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. I'll give you an example. A couple of the guys I went to rehab with. Now, rehabs are great. As soon as you walk through the door, you're an alcoholic. They brand you on the head with a stamp. Okay? They don't give you the dignity of figuring it out yourself. My roommate was not an alcoholic. He had the habit. He had that physical craving, and he would go into withdrawal without alcohol. But once he was withdrawn from alcohol, he's fine. He hasn't had a drink. His life is fine. He's not a resentful, bitter person. He's okay. You know what I mean? And I know another guy. He's a carpenter that I worked with. Same exact thing. Went to CAI, got detoxed, said, I don't need any of your head shrinking, thanks. After 3 days, he walked out. He's been fine. He's been fine. And he even has champagne at, you know, special occasions. He can stop or moderate, although he had to be detoxed. That does not define an alcoholic. An alcoholic is someone who they'll go over a little bit later, who has the obsession of the mind. They cannot control their intake. They can't decide that they're not going to ever drink again and then never drink again. You know, they can't be detoxed and then be fine the rest of their lives. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. That's one qualifier. You'll lose control over how much you drink once you start. Here's the fellow who's been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. These are also things that you turn statements into questions. And I always like to pick on T. T does absurd, incredible, and tragic things while drinking. T is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. T is seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk.
Wow.
His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. Ask yourself if these things are true in your case. Chris may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. I got to the point where I was answering the door of my house with a loaded .38 handgun because of paranoia. I lived in fucking Basking Ridge, you know? Like, who's going to come around robbing you in Basking Ridge? Somebody walks a dog without a leash and makes the municipal court section in Basking Ridge, you know? And I would answer the door with a handgun. It would be like a Girl Scout selling cookies or something. I was dangerously antisocial. I also had a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. My favorite example of this is, I'm getting my license back from a third DWI. Okay, I walked the entire 80s, and I'm getting my license back I finally got all the paperwork together. T, you know what it's like to get your license back. Forget about it. I mean, I had to go down to Wayne like 20 times. Finally, I've got all the paperwork together, and they have to get... I had to take the driver's test. It was me and 35 17-year-olds taking the driver's test. I'm like in my 30s getting my license back. Anyway, I drive down to Wayne. But, you know, I really have a problem with authority and walking into buildings with a lot of people, you know. So I have to have a drink. So I, you know, have a couple of pops. And I walk in, I sit down at this woman's desk, and she's the one that's going to finally give, you know, stamp my paper, and I can go get my license. And I go, I got this, and I'm throwing down all the paperwork. I finally got all the ducks in a row, and she starts sniffing me. She goes, you've been drinking. I go, no. She goes, yes, you have. I smell vodka on you. I was like, I'll tell you what. She goes, did you drive here? I'm like, no, I didn't drive here. I ended up like running through the woods and doubling back to get to my car. But I mean, she finally had to give me the slip of paper. I mean, I had her cold, you know. She had to give me the slip of paper, and she hands it to me, but she won't let go. You know, it's like a tug of war. She's like, trying to protect society from me. Now, if I had any choice in whether I drank or not, would I do something so stupid as to get drunk before I went to get my license back for a third DWI? No way. That's insane. Another time, I got drunk before my daughter was baptized, and I had to send one of my friends as me. I had to tell him to pretend he was me. I was too drunk to go to the baptism. You know, would I do something so bad if I had control? I have little or no control over when I drink or how much I drink. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect, he's incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. Has anyone in here ever done that? You know it. You know, you just get to the point where your head's above water, you got a new place to live, you got your license back, you got a car, you know, you got a job, and it explodes. He's a fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around, yet early the next morning he searches madly for a bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves before he can go to work. Anybody in here ever use high-powered sedatives with booze? Xanax and vodka was mine. Yeah, just to eat. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and he gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to the doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. They stay away from the morphine, but if you know the doctor pretty good, he'll give you a Librium. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. Let's just change that to rehabs and detoxes. This is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary. But this description should identify him roughly. It identifies the low-bottom alcoholic. And that's basically what this book was concerned with. You do not have to be a low-bottom alcoholic to be an alcoholic. Basically, what I get from the text is you really need to have two things. You need to have the obsession of the mind, which is you cannot quit drinking entirely on your own unaided will. And number two, you need to have the phenomenon of craving develop when you start drinking. I'll give you an example for that. If you don't have both of those, you don't have a problem. I'll give you an example. Let's say you have the phenomenon of craving but not the obsession of the mind. Then just never drink again. Or let's say you have the obsession of the mind but you don't have the physical craving. Then every time you pick up a drink, control it. You know, just have what you want to have. You know, what's the problem? You really need to have both of those to be considered an alcoholic. But that doesn't mean you have to be a low bottom. I can relate to people who've never left their house, never had any of the drama of the crashed cars, never had any of the drama of the rehabs or losing the families or anything, and they're just as much alcoholic as I am, you know? Why does he behave like this if hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its intended sufferings and humiliation? Why is it that he takes one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? We're talking about the obsession of the mind. Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why an alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as many do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. We've been involved mainly in the first step considerations in the Big Book. There's many, many pages that give us a lot of information, enough information that we can usually, through our own experience, confirm some of the truths about our alcoholism. I like to look at the first step in three parts. I like to look at it bodily, and that's basically what happens to us after the first drink, what happens to our body after the first drink. I like to look at it as far as our mind. Why can't we, when we decide to stop drinking for good and for all, which we've all done probably 30 times, if we've done it once, why haven't we been able to remain completely off of alcohol through our own willpower? And then the third part that oftentimes gets overlooked is the spirit malady, and that's basically things like we're not able to control our emotional natures, we're subject to misery and depression, we're restless, irritable, and discontented. There's many other emotional and spiritual problems that come along with alcoholism, whether we drink or not. And most of the time, the spirit malady we suffer from more when we're not drinking than when we're drinking, because to a certain extent, alcohol is a cure for our spirit malady. And I believe that the spirit malady is what aimed me into drinking alcohol. Because when I first started drinking alcohol, I felt the fear go away. I felt the emotional turmoil stop. A whole lot of things took place. So we're looking right now at the first step, and we're on page 23, at the top of page 23, if there is a solution. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. And here they're talking about our mental obsession. Why can't, you know, if we know what happens to us when we pick up a drink, if we end up in St. Clair's detox or Charlie Stuckey's Honesty House or some godforsaken place, why do we keep picking up booze? Why do we keep drinking? Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. If you ask him why he started out on that last bender, the chances are that he'll offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. I was baffled by why I was doing it night after night after night, you know, crashing cars and waking up on the floor and having nuclear hangovers just night after night after night. And there weren't really a whole lot of people that were close enough to me and really cared about me to ask me things like, why do you drink so much, Chris? You know, because I'd brushed those people away from me over the years, and I was just drinking with people who drank like me, and I was hanging out with people who my behavior would be acceptable with. I just had to. But if you would have asked me, why do I keep doing it, I don't think I would have known. I was caught up in something that was stronger than me, I knew that, but I couldn't have really verbalized what was going on with me. Once in a while he may tell the truth, and the truth, strange to say, is that usually he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they're down for the count. And my obsession was, somehow, someday, I'll be able to use alcohol successfully like I had previously. In my first 3 or 4 years of drinking, the high school and early college drinking, it was great. I had a great time. Sure, I crashed cars and got arrested and stuff like that, but that was a small price to pay for the amount of fun I was having. But later on in my drinking, I was just basically drinking for oblivion, and everything was bleak, and I had no friends left. My family was gone. I was just drinking alone up in a room. Someday, I really obsessed on being able to enjoy my drinking like I used to. But the problem is because it's a progressive disease, there's no way in hell I ever could regain the control to be able to enjoy my drinking. How true this is, few realize. In a vague way, their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal, but everyone hopefully awaits the day when the sufferer will rouse himself from its lethargy and assert his power of will. I truly believe this. Unless you're an alcoholic and you've suffered from the things we've suffered from, you do not understand why we don't just stop. You know what I mean? You just don't. Why doesn't that person stop? It's like, I'm not a food addict, but I know people who have addictions to food. And I think, well, what the hell did you eat 2 cakes for? You know what I mean? But because I don't understand the food addiction where flour creates a phenomenon of craving and you eat 2 cakes. I never experienced that, so I don't know. So I look at a food addict like they're out of their mind. You know, not really, but you know what I mean? I just don't understand. Well, I think the same thing happens with the non-alcoholic. They look at us and they say, well, why don't you just stop drinking? You know, it's like the guy banging themselves on the head with a hammer repeatedly. Stop banging yourself on the head with a hammer. The tragic truth is that if a man be a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. That says right there that if you can stop drinking for good and for all under your own willpower, you are not an alcoholic, at least the type of alcoholic that the Big Book is describing in its description. The alcoholic is the person who has lost the power to control when they drink and how much they drink when they drink. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case before it is suspected. That's what kills us. By the time we realize there's a problem, we're too far past the point of being able to do anything about it ourselves. One of the statements I like is the chains of alcoholism are too soft to feel until they're too strong to break. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. And you still hear, today I choose not to use, or just don't drink even if your ass falls off. You hear all kinds of things like that. And that's really a misrepresentation of the first step. The first step basically is, if you really are an alcoholic, you don't have any control over whether you drink or not. You can surround yourself with AA meetings, and that can create an atmosphere of sobriety. But our book tells us that without a spiritual awakening, we are not going to be safe and protected against the first drink, without a spiritual awakening. So there are many things that Alcoholics Anonymous can offer one that will keep one from drinking. And I think the greatest is the steps, which will offer the spiritual solution to our problems, which will place us in the hands of God, who will place us in a position of neutrality, safe and protected from alcohol. And solve a lot of other problems along the way, like the spirit malady and things like that. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. And you hear things like, I come to AA to keep my memory green. Like keeping your memory green is a satisfactory guard against picking up the first drink. Our book tells us that it's not. Keeping your memory green is not sufficient defense against the first drink. It's not. It may work 99 times out of 100, but there can come that time when thinking that, oh my God, I'm going back to the Salvation Army, that's not going to be a sufficient defense against the first drink. Not pointing any fingers. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. So sometimes if we do think, oh my God, this may not be the best thing in the world for me to do, the thought won't be sufficient enough to keep us from picking up the drink. We won't think, in other words, if just before the drink I thought to myself, well, I think I'll ruin my family's financial position, I think I'll lose my job, humiliate myself in front of all my friends and everyone I know, have to go off to rehab, ruin my credit rating, go to Honesty House and end up having to cook for them for the next 6 months during aftercare, I think I'll have a drink. I mean, that's not how I'm going to think if the time is going to come for me to pick up a drink. It'll be something like this. Yeah, I know, but God damn it, I just need a half an hour of that feeling. You know, I just need a half an hour escape. You know, that'll be the kind of thought. It'll be a lie. It'll end up being a lie. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. I got to give an experience, a personal experience about this. Well, I think it was fifth or sixth or seventh grade. It was my first year at junior high. There was this guy named Huey, and we all used to call him Baby Huey because he was about 210 pounds in like seventh grade. He's this huge guy. And in the hallways, we each had our locker, and it was combination lockers. And you know how kids play pranks on other kids. What you would do to play a prank on somebody is you'd come up behind them while they're getting their books out, and you'd slam their locker shut. Then they'd have to go through all the whole pain in the ass of turning the combination and opening their locker back up, and you get a good laugh while you're walking off down the hallway. Well, I used to do this to Huey all the time. I kind of thought we were buddies. You know, I used to pick on him and slam his locker every chance I got. Well, I picked slamming his locker on a bad day for Huey. Okay, he was having a bad day, and he didn't appreciate having his locker. He grabbed me by the shoulders. I was maybe 95 pounds at this time, and he was like 200. He grabs me by the shoulders, and he lifts me up, and he starts slapping my head against the concrete wall of the hallway. It's like a cinder block wall. I'm going, wham, wham. He knocked me completely unconscious, and I was laying on the floor. And I came to after classes had started, and the halls were empty. And I get up, and I stagger my way, you know, into class and sit down. And I thought to myself, God damn it, that's the last time I slam his locker shut. You know what I mean? It was fun to do, but I paid a consequence. I got knocked out. Well, how many times did I pick up alcohol and get knocked out? How many times did I grab the bottle of bourbon and end up on the floor with my head split open or something? It would have been like me going up to Baby Huey the next day and slamming his locker shut again and having him knock me out. And then going up the next day and having slamming his locker shut. I mean, that's completely insane. Well, it's completely insane to keep drinking when alcohol reacts the way it does in me. It's completely insane for me to keep drinking. But I don't have the defense that keeps me from being able to stop slamming the locker shut. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, it won't burn me this time, so here's how. Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way and after the third or the fourth pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, for God's sake, how did I ever get started again? Only to have that thought supplanted by, well, I'll stop at the sixth drink or what's the use anyway. This happened to me a lot of times. I was a great bar pounder. You know what I mean? I decided after 6 months of sobriety to buy a gallon of vodka and go home and drink it. And once I started getting drunk on that vodka, I realized what I had done. So when was I insane? When I was drinking the vodka or before? Our book says we're insane before we pick up the drink. They're not talking about the kind of insanity where you run around naked in the police station, you know, when you're drunk out of your mind. That's what you're supposed to do when you drink like we do. You're supposed to crash cars, and you're supposed to get in fights, and you're supposed to wake up with one shoe. You know, that's what you're supposed to do when you drink like we do. The insanity comes before the first drink. Why the hell do we keep drinking? When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. Not the best of news. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history, but for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations So many want to stop, but they cannot. So they've painted us in a corner. They've just told us we're doomed. You know what I mean? If you really fully concede your innermost self, the truth of these pages, you realize that you have an obsession of the mind that will force you to pick up a drink against your will, and you have a body that's so sickened by alcohol abuse that you will not be able to stop drinking, and it will ultimately destroy you. You know, so it's not great news. You cannot move into step two feeling good about yourself. If you do move into step two feeling gleeful, you've missed something. You need to go back, because it's not the greatest thing. But there is a solution. Almost none of us have liked the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. Let's just consider for a minute that sentence means exactly what it says. The self-searching would be the fourth step. The leveling of our pride would be the fifth step, and quite possibly the eighth and the ninth step. Confession of our shortcomings, the fifth step, which with the process requires for its successful consummation. It says these steps are suggested as a program of recovery. That's very, very misleading, because throughout the rest of the text, it says things like you're quite sure to drink if you do this or don't do this, or if you don't do this, it's basically it requires it for successful consummation of our spiritual experience. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and the futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, the people who had worked through the steps and are now 12-stepping us, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we have not even dreamed. And that's a great promise, And you'll know what that fourth dimension of reality is once you've done the steps. And you will not know what it is until you have. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life and toward our fellows and toward God's universe. A complete personality change at depth. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. And that's the conscious contact. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. And the first thing He did with me was He removed the obsession to drink alcohol long enough for me to be able to get sober and start the recovery process. And that indeed was miraculous. If you knew how I drank and how obsessed I was with it, it would have only been through an act of divine providence that I would have been able to stop drinking for the period of time that I did, so I could slowly sort out my actions to the point of arranging my actions to lead to some type of recovery. If you have as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. This is great. It shows us a fork in the road. It doesn't show us a road map with 10 million ways to get to Albuquerque. It really just shows us a fork in the road. And we can go one way or we can go the other. And I believe everyone in this room is going one way or they're going the other. They're either going toward a drink or they're going away from it. It says, one was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. That means to just disregard this book, don't worry about, not wanting what other people have in AA, not willing to go to any lengths to get it, to just basically just want to stop drinking, but not be willing to do any of the work. And the other is to accept spiritual help. Accepting spiritual help is not an easy thing to do. It was very, very difficult for me. I had to have what is known in AA as a bottom. I had to be put in a position where I was willing to do whatever needed to be done to not go any lower. I had to be put in a position where I was willing to take advice from people I thought that were stupider than me. I had to be put in a position to follow examples and take actions which I knew in my heart would not work for me because I was different. I had to be desperate. And I'll tell you what, the most fun people in the world to work with, if you're sponsoring or doing 12-step work, the best people in the world to work with are the desperate ones. Mm-hmm. They are an absolute joy to work with. And they're actually in a better position to be helped than the people who haven't drank as much as they have, just because of their ability to be more willing.